Hi, this is Philip Meyer, welcoming you to another episode of Talking About Platforms.
And we are Daniel Trabucchi
and Thomas Buganza, the co-hosts of this podcast, where we present and discuss relevant discoveries from the field of platform research.
In every episode, we have a guest sharing with us one of his or her latest insights on platforms, starting from a paper, a project, or a book to make it accessible to everyone.
And with that, let's just jump right into the conversation.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Talking About Platforms. I'm Daniel Trabucchi, and here with me, I have my regular co-host, Thomas Buganza.
Hi, hello.
And today we have the pleasure to have, I would say, the first Italian-American guest of the podcast, Chiara Farronato, Associate Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. Hi, Chiara, and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Okay, so Chiara, we were discussing if it was a good idea to do it in Italian. We decided not to, so we will keep going on with English. So Chiara, we actually start every single episode with our guests with the same question, and it is, how did you end up talking about platforms and researching about platforms? Because everybody's got a different trajectory and a different story. And, in answering, you can also provide us with your definition of platforms. So what do you mean by platforms? Because this is another thing that we discovered in these years. We all do research about platforms, but in many, many cases with different angles, different perspectives. So tell us about it.
Yes. So I am very curious if at some point you collect all of the definitions of platforms that you have received, because it's true. It's one of those fields where we have to start by making sure that we're talking about the same thing. The way I define platforms is sort of based on the most important thing that I think platforms do, which is they aggregate information from many fragmented users that often belongs to different groups, right? Buyers and sellers, hosts and guests, drivers and passengers. And so platforms collect a lot of information, fragmented information. They aggregate it, they repackage it, and they redistribute it in a way that allows for valuable exchanges among all those fragmented users that are on those platforms. So really, what is key in my mind is the role of information aggregators. And then depending on the specifics of the platform, well, they do something more concrete, right? So they may facilitate payments, they may ensure trust, they may have a GPS system so the driver knows where to pick up and drop off the passenger. But really the core common thing that is of interest in my research is this information aggregator role. How did I get into studying it? A little bit by chance, actually. I moved to California in 2009. And 2009, for those younger than me, was really the year where a lot of these platforms popped up in the backyard of Stanford University, which is where I was doing my PhD. Airbnb was founded around then, Uber was founded around then, Lyft was founded around them, TaskRabbit for IKEA furniture assembly. And so they were literally there in our backyard while I was studying and I was trying to figure out what to do during my PhD. I happened, through my collaborations with the faculty who then became my advisors, to work on eBay, on auctions on eBay. And that gave me a really good sense of what large data is, how to sort of investigate it, how to manipulate it. And then it was kind of natural to say, okay, I've learned a lot from how eBay e-commerce platforms work. can I extend some of those learnings to some of the companies that are much smaller, are willing to share some data, and may be helpful to, you know, continue my dissertation. So that's how I got in. And when I moved to Harvard Business School, I realized that there was a lot of interest in what I was doing. And so I stuck with it.
Well, you mentioned the beginning of probably the highest part of the platform revolution, 2009, with Airbnb and all their friends. And we can easily say that 15 years later, the knowledge of on platforms is definitely different, but especially the impact that platforms start having on our daily life, on our cities, and you know, on our habits. And we've been through your work, and we are very interested in the work you've been doing on Airbnb and the effect that this is having in cities. Here in Italy, we are talking about over the last months of this war that is over tourism, the fact that there are cities in which there are too many people going there to visit it in the same moment. And this is having probably effects on the quality of life in those cities and in the affordability of those cities. So we know you've been into that area. So we'd like to know something more about that, about what you found there.
Yeah, absolutely. And first, I should say, I was the victim of over tourism in Rome last summer when I actually took my kids there with a bunch of other friends and their kids. And it was really terrifying to walk around Piazza di Spagna, for example, or by the Vatican, and being scared that these tiny little kids would be lost in the crowds. Having said that, I don't know whether it's just the fault of Airbnb. So let me be very, very, very clear. And by the way, it's not just a problem in Europe. For example, actually, about a year ago now, New York has effectively passed legislation that has completely banned what we consider sort of short-term rentals, Airbnb. And to me, that's not the right approach sort of to solve what is something that we may have all experienced over tourism, but also something else that the cities, especially here in the US, are really worried about, which is really high rents, really high home value that excludes certain segments of the population from being able to afford housing. So that's sort of the biggest problem here in the US as I see it. The over-tourism is the biggest problem as I see it in Europe. And for whatever reason, you know, the scapegoat is Airbnb. So let me tell you what with Andre Fratkin, we found out about the real value that Airbnb creates in the accommodations market. And then given that value, how do we go about trying to balance it with potential effects on housing affordability and potential effects on over tourism. So really the main value that Airbnb creates is by allowing flexible supply to come into a market that is fundamentally supplied by dedicated supply. Think about hotel rooms. They're always available 365 days a year. They're there, open, and if they're not used by guests, they tend to stay empty, okay? Now, do we think of travelers' demand to be fixed, to be stable over time? Well, actually, no. We have a lot of fluctuations. We have people who want to travel during peak seasons, and people stay home, right, off the big traveling seasons. So serving that kind of demand with dedicated supply is very, very inefficient. You end up on some days with many empty rooms, and you end up in some days with a lot of people who would like to book those rooms but cannot because they're fully occupied. Okay? And so this is a market that it's kind of inefficient because demand is fluctuating and supply is kind of fixed. Airbnb has allowed to bring in a form of supply that is very responsive to demand. So it shows up right? In Paris during the Olympic Games, or in Brazil during the World Cup. And that is highly beneficial because it allows for travelers to find accommodation when they need it, without leaving those rooms completely empty in periods when that demand is much lower. So the benefit is not just providing that additional form of accommodation to people who otherwise would have been priced out of hotels. But even for the people who stay in hotels, they face lower prices in those peak demand periods because there is now more price pressure in those periods. And so there's huge benefits from this type of supply. Those huge benefits are highly concentrated in a small number, in a short sort of time frame within a calendar year, those periods where there's a lot of demand. And so having said that, right, if that's the value that Airbnb creates, how do we try and preserve it while sort of minimizing, right, over tourism or some housing units being taken away from, say, long-term rentals into short-term rentals. I don't think banning is the solution because it basically completely kills the benefits that I just described, right? But maybe you can put caps, okay? So caps in the total number of nights that a host can host on Airbnb, right? And many cities actually in Europe have adopted that policy. The other is, well, maybe we can put a cap of 1% of the housing supply. And so you actually request licenses through, you know, your city government. And when that city government reaches 1% of the housing supply, in particular in certain neighborhoods, well, it doesn't, you know, release more licenses. Those to me seem like more smarter, more balanced regulations than complete bans, given the benefits to the accommodations market.
Well, I think it's super interesting what you're saying because it's I was thinking that you're European,
yeah.
And in a certain way, it's easy to see that when you are talking because let me change a little bit the topic and then we go back. But what's happening now, for example, in the United States? With Google and all of his idea of chunking the company and splitting the company because it's too big. So it's too big, and the problem is that it's taking advantage of many on many different markets and so on. And it's interesting because basically it seems that we are underestimating the value that this company is providing to us. So especially because you can connect the search engine with the maps, with the email, with the calendar, with everything connected at the same time. They can, for example, have the data to sell services and all of these things are for free. If you start splitting the company and you avoid the connection, the so-called, horizontal network analysis among the different applications, you might actually create a problem to the final users. And I feel that what you are talking about in terms of Airbnb is quite similar. So we are concentrating on the negative effects, but for sure, we can see in many cities, it's very difficult to find, to rent an apartment if you want to live there, prison and so on. But we, in a certain way, it seems that we are forgetting that there are also such incredible good things for users. And probably if you ask users, they would rather prefer to go on like this instead of just banning it. And it's interesting because the American approach, now, correct me if I'm wrong, but seems to be you need to, a ban, you need to chunk, you need to split. So you need to reduce the power of the company in order not to have these big effects. On the other side, if you look at Europe, we are the regulations house. It's like, we can regulate it, which means we need to intervene on the market, which is something that is, different, but we put some rules. So what you said before, to fix the number of licenses, Milan is doing it. Starting from January next year, all the houses, they will we will have a license, but then there will be a regulation for the new licenses as well. So it's and you got the number of nights in a year, in a month, and stuff like that. And I see in a certain way that you live in the United States, but you are still keeping with you this kind of European approach. Am I right?
There's a lot to unpack in what you're saying. A lot of it, which I agree, a lot of it that I think I would add some context. I think it is true that the Department of Justice now has asked for, you know, a breakup of Google, which I don't really think it's going to happen anytime soon. And it's also true that there seems to be, you know, flip-flopping between two extremes. For a really long time, we have sort of adopted a laissez-faire approach towards these big techs, and we've allowed them to grow really without any sort of controls. But now I think the risk is that we're over-adjusting. It's not obvious to me that Europe is not over-adjusting as well, in a sense. Right. I think the Digital Markets Act is a set of, rather than expose, let's break these companies up. It's a set of ex ante prohibitions that say, okay, you are big enough, regardless of sort of your market share, we deem you big enough. And so we want you to abide by at least a set of prohibitions and obligations that really sort of follow two core principles of fairness and contestability, right? Fairness of, you know, we are all competing on the same ground. And so, for example, Amazon is not allowed to self-preference its own products on the platform. Now, that's easier said than done, I would say. And contestability, meaning, well, you know, we have to make sure that we give market competition a chance. And so, for example, if you're Google and you have a leg up because you can combine data across different services, well, you are going to be better in each individual services, and we don't want to allow that. So even in the European context, for example, combining data from different services is currently, under certain circumstances, prohibited. But I agree with you that we need to find sort of a middle ground between extremes of now we're all scared and we need to completely adjust, or we don't do anything and we just let them continue to grow unconstrained.
Okay. There's a lot of things that you said. It's interesting because we are, in a certain way, our discussion, our chat is moving towards, shall we chunk them, split them, or shall we regulate them? Somewhere in this narrative, there is basically the idea that too big is not good. So too big is not good. You have impasse is not good. And I'd like to challenge this as well, because I'm not sure that this must be the narrative. So what if we try to do something else? So these big companies, they leverage these huge externalities and they get to the point in which they have got an impact on society. What if the impact on society was positive instead of a negative? Because we are focusing on the many problems that they can create. But in a certain way, risk, you're right, absolutely right. We are overreacting. And there is the risk that because we see some problems now, we are somehow preventing us from having good effects instead of bad effects. So we got huge challenges, so-called grand challenges at the world level. And I think that if platforms are designed to have a positive impact, instead of designed to do business, and then you discover that there might be a negative impact. If we turn completely the story and we start by designing for having a positive impact, we are in front of a huge, huge opportunity. And I'm scared that focusing on the negative, we might lose it, or we might lose time to it.
I completely agree with you, Tommaso. I think there's a over-indexing of the risks. And some of those risks maybe are legitimate around fake news and misinformation. Some of the risks maybe are overblown. Like, I would love to poll, you know, everybody and say we are worse off because we have Amazon or Google today. I don't think many people are going to raise their hand saying we're worse off because we have Amazon or Google today, right? But there is a legitimate question of, you know, how can external academics, regulators really assess, right, the impact that these companies are having on the broader society? Because as I said before, these companies are information aggregators, so they have a lot of information that one could use to see whether they are doing something well for the society, net, right, and where the risks lie. And instead, at least in the eyes of the regulator and in the eyes of many academics like us, these companies are kind of black boxy. We really don't know what is going on inside. And so part of my research right now is actually trying to look at ways in which we can collect data from these companies without necessarily collaborating with them, because that creates, you know, interesting incentives to work on questions that are aligned, right, between the academic and the company. But I'm trying to work to try and find ways to collect data on the company, on the workings of this company, to try and get a sense of where the pendulum swing. Is it net positive or is it net negative? Because we oftentimes, when we think about this regulation, we do it without having a sense of the quantification of the real trade-off. We know them in theory. We don't know the actual effects.
You know, we come to platforms from a slightly different perspective. So we tend to take the perspective of how big established firms can rely on platform-based mechanisms to foster innovation. Said in a different word, what can big companies learn from Airbnb and Uber? But in a way, we are getting, at least in my perspective, to something very similar. We are probably living in a world where the overlapping between the model, the platforms, and some big names happens too often. Like, platforms is not Airbnb, and the fact that there is over-tourism is not Airbnb fault, and removing Airbnb wouldn't necessarily took away the over-tourism issues. On the other way around, if we leverage the platform model, looking at Airbnb in a positive outlook, we can probably have a regulation that can rely on the mechanism to have a wider good for all the stakeholders involved. My question is, how can we help in a way? Meaning that it seems to me that when we talk with managers, there is this kind of equation, which is platforms means digital, whatever it is, but it's technology, it's not a matter of a model. And it seems to me that when we look at it from the regulation perspective, it seems like platforms equal problems or anyhow situations to be handled. How can we make it a bit more complicated, but trying to leverage it in a more positive way? What can we do? What is missing in your opinion?
That's an important and difficult question to answer, actually. I think right now digital platforms are facing both a lot of like local regulation and a lot of global regulation or clash. I think the companies that are affected by each are different in a sense. So for example, Airbnb is not large enough to having to comply with the Digital Markets Act and the Digital Services Act, right? But it also has a host of regulation that is actually very, very different across different geographies that they sort of need to ensure that their hosts and themselves are compliant with. It's interesting that you say, how can we, you know, ensure that the value that they create gets shown. I think there is a lot of mistrust in how these companies are working, and in part, I would say, maybe the fault of how these companies are working, because they are not transparent necessarily, and sometimes news come out of the fact that they knew something about, for example, their role in affecting depression, right, on Facebook, and they never disclosed it, or in the fact that on Uber, they were charging higher to people who had low remaining batteries on their phone, right? So these companies are very good at, to some extent, exploiting the many biases of consumer behavior. And when some of that information comes out, it pollutes the entire sort of perception that we have of these platforms. And I think it's also the role of the platform to do a better job at being transparent and say, no, we are not going to charge based on the, you know, battery level of your smartphone. And if we find something that affects, you know, teenagers' mental well-being, we are going to disclose it. That, I think, is going to serve them better in the long term than keeping it hidden, and then at some point it's going to come out.
It's interesting. It's like if it's like when you have an issue within a couple, like the two parties that are turning slightly into opposite directions. We wrote a paper a couple of years ago talking about business model transparency that meant clearly explaining what's going on behind the scene in a way that people can actually understand it. In our opinion, the role of the platform should be creating multiple value propositions that are, yes, independent for each site, for each set of stakeholders, but also joined together by a unique value proposition that is the reason why the platform is there and it's keeping all together. And probably this is slipping away in some of the big cases now, without talking about anyone in particular, but the chance to over-rely on the weakest or the most profitable side of the platform probably create this lack of transparency in the overall mechanism that create a mistrust that then on the other side of the couple can generate a behavior that becomes over-regulation or not full understanding of the system that is there. So probably we need to find a way to have the couple back together and looking themselves.
It's actually, there's an example that I have in mind where, you know, there's incumbents, traditional incumbents, and sort of new technology entrants. And in the US, there's a lot of lobbying. And my sense is that, you know, the old incumbents are more trusted than the new technology platforms when it comes to lobbying and shaping regulation. And I don't understand why. There's actually a professor from Stanford GSB Callender, who has a theory model of a signaling game, where he actually shows that it's in the interest of the regulator to actually trust the incumbent. And so it's a little bit disappointing to have a theory model that justifies this behavior. But at the same time, I think it's a reality that is in part the responsibility of these new technology platforms that then some of them have already become incumbents, right, to fix. they need to gain the trust of society and they need to gain the trust of the regulators, or else it will be, a continual conflict.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be simple for at least two reasons. I got the feeling, I don't know if you see the same in the US, but I got the feeling that the average level of real understanding of how they create value by managers and people who are normal people not working into platforms or in the search and so is quite low. And and as a result, people have got this, in many cases, people have got this idea that actually they make a lot of money doing nothing. So they don't put the house. They don't do that. They just created a very simple software, and it gets on a phone, and the software is for free. So it seems to be like a game, and these kids seems to be, they see them as kids, very powerful, very geeky, very 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 rich, but actually it's easier to imagine that you've got a lot of knowledge and trust in doing an engineering for a turbine instead of a digital platform. I think that this is part of the game. The other part of the game is that they are not doing that much to be trustworthy. And so now we said that we don't make name, but it caught my attention a lot some months ago. Sam Altman, when he said, please. Put some rules and give us some regulation. So why don't you do it yourself? So it's like we know that we are managing big stuff, but we prefer somebody else to put the rules because otherwise I will not put the rules myself. And it's this kind of communication is definitely not helping, I think. So I think you're right. I probably never focused it so clearly. People don't trust them. So it's easier to trust. It's easier to trust, let's say, Siemens or, I don't know, or AXA. And it's more difficult to trust them. So, Chiara, this was a wonderful chat, but we normally love to close every chat by asking our guests, what's the next thing on your desk? So what is the thing that is really, really, really taking your time, your attention? When you wake up in the morning, you think about that. What is the next great big thing we should expect from you?
Well, thank you for asking that. I'm actually very excited about these sort of relatively novel approach in which we can collect data about how consumers interact online with some of these platforms. In the past couple of years, I've put a lot of my effort, and I should say Andre Fratkin's effort as well, in developing a technology, a web browser extension that we can ask people who are listening to this podcast, for example, to install on their browser. And this technology can actually change some of the things that consumers see when they browse online and track their behavior. We've started using this technology together also with Alex McKay to study vertical integration on Amazon and see what happens, for example, when we remove Amazon brands from the choice set of consumers who otherwise regularly shop on Amazon. We have also started looking at consumer preferences online for privacy with Tessa Rilin by looking at whether, removing the reject all cookie button from the choices that people make when they browse various websites is actually very effective at changing those preferences. And so these are two initial sort of works of what I hope is going to be a much more mainstream way of studying online behavior. So if you're interested, we have a website, webmunk.org, because it's a chipmunk, so M-U-N-K. It's a chipmunk that collects web data. And so that's how we created this name, webmunk.org. It's open sourced, and already some other researchers are thinking of using this. And I'm hoping that we'll all together jointly will learn a lot more about the operations of these companies to do smarter and better regulation while ensuring consumer welfare, profitability for these companies so that they can survive long term without hurting, you know, human rights while doing so.
Oh, that's great. You partially anticipated the answer of the very final question, which is how would you suggest people listening to the podcast to be in touch with you? We will definitely put in the short note of the episode the reference to the articles you mentioned and to the website you mentioned. But if someone would like to know something more about your work at large, do you have any profile you suggest listeners to look for?
You can Google Chiara HBS. I usually am the first result on Google. At some point, there was a case actually for the Italians who know Chiara Ferragni. There was an HBS case study on Chiara Ferragni. So if you looked for Chiara at that time, she would be the first one coming out. I have now overtaken apparently Chiara Ferragni. So you can search for me on Chiara HBS. I have my profile online. I have my email online. You can reach out, not on LinkedIn, because I try not to be distracted by a lot of the social media alternatives and networking media alternatives that we have online. But I typically reply to emails. So feel free to reach out there.
That's great. It was great to have this bit of Italy from the United States in this episode. Thank you very much for joining us and for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really enjoyable, actually.
Thank you, Chiara. Ciao.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Talking About Platforms.
You can rate the podcast on every major podcast app. This helps us a lot in growing.
Visit talkingaboutplatforms.com to get the links of the short notes, reach out to us, and see the previous episodes.
Hear you in another episode to talk about platforms.